Chapter 6. The beetle that walks slowly has nothing to fear. Safi saying. Coated in dust-spattered blood, Vedith rode out of the billowing smoke. In his wake, piteous screams and the raucous roar of flames as they engulfed the three-story government building in the town center. Most of the other structures lining the main street were already gutted, although fires still licked the blackened frames and the foul smoke lifted pillars skyward. Four other riders emerged behind Vedith, scimitars unsheathed, the iron steel blades streaked with gore. Hearing their wild whoops, Vedith scowled. The mangled round shield strapped to his right forearm had driven splinters through the wrist, and that hand could not grip the reins. In his left hand, he held his own scimitar. The blade snapped a hand's width above the hilt. He would have thrown it away, but he valued the hilt, grip, and pommel too much to part with it. His horse's reins dragged between the beast's front legs, and at any moment the galloping mount, in her fear and pain, might slam a hoof down on them, which would snap her neck down and send her rider tumbling. He rose in his stirrups, leaned forward, pounded by the horse's pitching neck, and bit the animal's left ear, tugging backwards. Squealing, the beast's head lifted, her plunging hoofs slowing, drawing up. This gave Vedith time to sheathe what was left of his father's sword and then slip his arm round the horse's neck, easing the pressure of his teeth. Moments later, the wounded mare pitched and wobbled down off the cobbled road into the high grasses of the ditch and clumped to a halt, body trembling. Murmuring calming words, the warrior released the animal's ear and settled back on the saddle, collecting the reins with his one usable hand. His four companions rode up, and beasts jostling on the road, they held their swords high in triumph, even as they spat dust and blood from their mouths. Vedith felt sick, but he understood the growing list of prescriptions, the ever-dwindling freedom, the indignities and undisguised contempt. Each day in the past week, more Balkando soldiers had arrived, fortlets springing up round the Kundril encampment like mushroom knuckles on dung. And tensions twisted ever tighter, arguments burst to life like spot fires, and then, all at once, he guided his horse back onto the road and glared back at the burning town. And then scanned the horizons to either side. Columns of coiling black smoke rose everywhere like crooked spears. Yes, the patience of the burned tears was at an end, and he knew that a dozen villages, twice as many hamlets, scores of farms, and now one town, had felt the wrath of the Kundril. Vedith's raiding party, 30 warriors, most of them barely into their third decade, had clashed with the garrison. The fighting had been ferocious. He'd lost most of his troop, and this had been fuel enough to set ablaze the Kundril fury, inflicting wrathful vengeance upon wounded soldiers and the civilian inhabitants of the town. The taste of that slaughter left a bitter, toxic stain, inside and out. His horse could not hold still. Her slashed flank still bled freely. She circled, head tossing, kicking with the wounded hind leg. They'd left scores of corpses in that nameless town. This very morning it had been a peaceful place, life awakening and crawling on to the old familiar trails, a slow beating heart. Now it was ruin and charred meat. They'd not even bothered looting, so fierce upon them was the lust for slaughter. To a proud people, the contempt of others drives the deepest wound. These Balkando had thought the Kundril knives were dull. Dull knives, dull minds. They had thought they could cheat the savages, mock them, ply them with foul liquor and steal their wealth.
"We are seven cities. Did you think you were the first to try to play such games with us?"
Stragglers were still emerging. Three, two. A lone wounded warrior slumped over his saddle. Two more. The soldiers of the garrison had not understood how to meet a cavalry charge. It was as if they had never before seen such a thing, gaping at the precise execution, the deadly timing of the javelins launched when the two sides were but a dozen paces apart. The Balkando line, formed up across the main street, had crumpled as the barbed javelins punched through shield and scale armor, as figures reeled, buckled, and fouled others. The Cundrill war horses and their howling scimitar-slashing riders then smashed into that tattered formation. A slaughter, until the rear sections of the Balkando dispersed, scattering into clumps, pelting into the side avenues, the alleys, the sheltered mouths of stone-faced shops. The battle broke up then, not spinning away. Cundrill warriors were forced to dismount, unable to press into the narrower alleys, or draw back out into the open, soldiers crouched behind drawn-up shields in the niches of doorways. Still outnumbered, warriors of the burned tears began falling. It had taken most of the morning to hunt down and butcher the last garrison soldier, and barely a bell to murder the townsfolk who had not fled, who had, presumably, imagined that 75 soldiers would prevail against a mere 30 savages, and then set fire to the town, roasting alive the few who had successfully hidden themselves. Such scenes, Verith knew, were raging across the entire countryside now. No one was spared, and to deliver the message in the clearest way imaginable, every Balkando farm was being stripped of anything and everything edible or otherwise useful. The revolt had been ignited by the latest Balkando price hike, 100% applicable only to the Cundrill, on all necessities, including fodder for the horses.
"Revile us, yes, even as you take our silver and gold."
He had a dozen warriors with him now, one of them likely to die soon, well before they reached the encampment, and six splinters rode up his forearm like extra long bones, pain throbbing. Yes, the losses had been high, but then what other troop had attacked a garrisoned town? Still, he wondered if, perhaps, the burned tears had kicked awake the wrong nest.
"Bind Sidab's wounds," he now said in a growl. "Has he his sword?"
"He has, Verdith."
"Give it to me. Mine broke."
Although he was dying and knew it, Sidab lifted his head at this and showed Verdith a red smile.
"It shall wait my hand as did my father's sword," Verdith said. "I shall wield it with pride, Sidab."
The man nodded, smile fading. He coughed out a gout of blood and then slid out of his saddle, thumping heavily onto the cobbled road.
"Sidab stays behind."
The others nodded and spat to make a circle round the corpse, thus sanctifying the ground, completing the only funeral ceremony needed for Cundrill warriors on the path of war. Verdith reached out and took up the reins of Sidab's horse. He would take the beast as well and ride it to ease his own mount's discomfort.
"We return to War Leader Gaul. Our words shall make his eyes shine."
War Leader Gaul sagged back into his antler and rope throne, the knots creaking.
"Coltane's sweet breath," he sighed, squeezing shut his eyes.
Jarab, tear runner to the war leader and the only other occupant of Gaul's tent, removed his helmet and then the padded doeskin cap and raked thick fingers through his hair before stepping forward and dropping to one knee.
"Command me," he said.
Gaul groaned.
"Not now, Jarab. The time for play's over. My four damned young braves have given us a war. 20 raids have howled back into camp, sacks filled with hens and pups and whatnot. I'd wager nigh on 1,000 innocent farmers and villagers already dead."
"And hundreds of soldiers, war leader," reminded Jarab. "The fortlets burn."
"And I've been coughing from the smoke all morning. We didn't need to torch them. That timber would have been useful. So we spit and snarl like a desert lynx in her lair. And what do you think King Tarkalf is going to do? Wait, never mind him. The man's got fungi for brains. It's the Chancellor and his cute conquestor we have to worry about. Let me tell you what they'll do, Jarab. They won't demand we return to this camp. They won't insist on reparations and blood coin. No, they'll raise an army and march straight for us."
"War leader," Jarab said, straightening. "Wild lands beckon us north and east. Once out on the plains, no one can catch us."
"All very well, but these Balkando aren't our enemy. They were supplying us.
We loot all we can before fleeing.
And won't the adjunct be thrilled by how we've smoothed the sand before her? This is a mess, Jarab, a mess.
What then will you do, war leader?
Gaul finally opened his eyes, blinked, and then coughed. After a moment, he said,
I won't try to mend what cannot be undone. This aids the adjunct nothing. No, we need to seize the bull's cock.
He surged to his feet, collected up his crow feather cloak.
Break this camp, kill all livestock, and start curing the meat. It will be weeks before the Balkando muster the numbers they need against us. To ensure safe passage of the bone hunters, not to mention the grey helms, we're going to march on the capital. We're going to pose such a threat that Tarkulf voids his bladder and overrules his advisers. I want the king thinking he might be facing a three-pronged invasion of his piss-ass latrine pit of a kingdom.
Jarab smiled. He could see the embers glowing in his war leader's dark eyes, which meant that once all the orders were barked and all the other runners were scrambling dust trails, Gaul's mood would be much improved. Sufficient, perhaps, to once more invite some play. All he need do was make sure the old man's wife was nowhere close. Shield Anvil Tanakalian shifted uncomfortably beneath his chain surcoat. The quilted underpadding had worn through on his right shoulder. He should have patched it this morning, and would have done so had he not been so eager to witness the landing of the first cohort of grey helms on this wretched ground. For all his haste, he found Mortal Sword Krukhava already positioned on the rise overlooking the shoreline, red-faced beneath her heavy helm. Though the sun was barely above the mountain peaks to the east, the air was stifling, oppressive, swarming with sandflies. As he approached, he could see in her eyes the doom of countless epic poems, as if she had devoted her life to absorbing the tragedies of 1,000 years' worth of fallen civilizations, finding the taste savagely pleasing. Yes, she was a holy terror, this hard iron woman. Upon arriving at her side, he bowed in greeting.
Mortal Sword, this is a portentous occasion.
Yet but two of us stand here, sir, she rumbled in reply, when there should be three.
He nodded. A new destriant must be chosen. Who among the elders have you considered, Mortal Sword? Four squat, broad-beamed Avars, the landing craft of the Thrones of War, were fast closing on the channel wending through the mudflats, oar blades flashing. The tide wasn't cooperating at all. The bay should be swelling with inflow. Instead, the water churned as if confused. Tanakalian squinted at the lead Avar, expecting it to run aground at any moment. The heavily burdened brothers and sisters would have to disembark and then slog on foot. He wondered how deep the mud was out there.
I am undecided, Krukhava finally admitted. None of our elders happens to be very old.
True enough. This long sea voyage had worn through the lives of a score or more of the most ancient brothers and sisters. Tanakalian swung round to study the two encampments situated 2,000 paces inland, one on this side of the river and the other on the opposite west side. As yet, there had been no direct contact with the Akrani delegation. If the mob of spike-haired, endlessly singing, spear-waving barbarians truly justified such an honorific, so long as they stayed on the other side of the river, the Akrani could sing until the mountains sank into the sea. The Balkando camp, an ever-burgeoning city of gaudy tents, was already a swarm, as if the imminent landing of the Perish had sent them into a frenzy. Strange people, these Balkando, scar-faced yet effete, polite yet clearly bloodthirsty. Tanakalian did not trust them, and it looked as if their escort through the mountain passes and into the kingdom amounted to an entire army, 3,000 or 4,000 strong. And though he didn't think the average Balkando soldier could hope to match a grey helm, still their sheer numbers were cause for concern.
Mortal Sword, he said, facing her once more, do we march into betrayal?
This journey must be considered one through hostile territory, Shield Anvil.
We will march in armor, weapons at hand. Should the Balkando escort precede us into the pass, then I shall have no cause for worry. Should they divide to form advance and rear elements, I will be forced to take measure of the strength of that rear guard. If it is modest, then we need have little concern. If it is overstrength relative to the advance element, then one must consider the possibility that a second army awaits us at the far end of the pass. Given, she added, that we must travel in column, such an ambush would put us at a disadvantage, initially at least.
We had best hope, observed Tanakalian, that they intend treating with us honorably.
If not, they will regret their temerity, sir.
Three legions, 18 cohorts and 3 supply companies, 5,000 brothers and sisters in the land force, the remaining legions would accompany the thrones of war on the ill-mapped sea lanes south of the coast, seeking the Palacia Sea. It had been the judgment of both the adjunct and Krughava that the burned tiers needed support. Given the reported scarcity of resources in the wastelands, the bone hunters would travel independent of the more southerly forces consisting of the Kundril, Mounted, and the Perish Foot Legions. The two elements would march eastward on parallel tracks, with perhaps 20 leagues between them, until reaching the borders of the First Kingdom beyond the wastelands. In Krughava's mind, Tanakalian well knew, a holy war awaited them. A singular purpose of their existence, and upon that foreign soil the Grey Helms would find their glory, their heroic triumph in service to the Wolves of Winter. He shared with her that sense of purpose, fate's bold promise, and like her, he did not fear war. They were trained in the ways of violence, sworn to those cusps of history hacked into shape on battlefields. With sword and will, they could change the world. Such was the truth of war, for all that soft fools might wish otherwise, might dream of peace and harmony between strangers. Romantics, with their wishful notions, invariably delivered the asp's bite, whether they sought to or not. Hope and faith seeped through like the sweetest nectar, only to sour into vile poison. Most virtues, Tanakalian well knew, were defenseless, abused and corrupted with ease, ever made to turn in the wielder's hand. It took a self-deluded mind to force justice upon a world when that world cared for nothing, when all reality mocked the righteous with its indifference. War swept such games aside. It was pure, unapologetic in its brutality. Justice arrived with the taste of blood, both sweet and bitter, and that too was as it should be. No, he would tell the mortal sword nothing of the Destriant's final words of terror, of his unmanned panic, the shrill clangor of his warnings. Such failings served no one, after all. Even so, Tanakalian vowed to remain watchful, wary, trusting nothing, and expecting betrayal from every stranger. Ran Servian was too old for war. Fear took his life. I could see that clearly enough. He was blind, driven to madness, babbling. It was all so undignified. The Avars had run aground over 100 paces from the high tide mark. Burdened soldiers stumbled shin-deep in fly-swarmed mud, whilst the crews struggled to drag the boats free to retrace their route back to the anchored thrones. They were in for a long day.
"Well, now,"
muttered Chancellor Rava as he perused the coded missive,
"our dear king seems to have led our precious kingdom into a royal mess."
A vault paced in front of the old man, from one side of the tent's shrouded chamber to the other. He could guess at most of the details hidden on the parchment in Rava's hands. The Chancellor's comment was, if the truth was laid bare, entirely inaccurate. The mess didn't come from King Tarkalf. In fact, it was without question the product of certain excesses among servants of the Chancellor, and, indeed, of Conquestor Avalt himself.
"What we now need to determine," he said, his voice still cracking from the tirade he had delivered a short time earlier to a select company of merchant agents and spies, "is the nature of the relationship between our parish friends and these Kundril bandits."
"True," Rava replied,
However, do recall that the parish seemed to hold to an absurdly elevated notion of honor. Once we present to them our version of the Cundrill's sudden, inexplicable rampage, once we speak of the atrocities and the slaughter of hundreds, if not thousands, of innocents, he smiled. I believe we shall see, to our blessed relief, a most stern disavowal from the mortal sword. Avault's nod was sharp. Which will permit me to concentrate my forces on crushing the Cundrill without having to worry about the parish. Rava's watery eyes seemed to slide from Avault as he asked, Is there cause for worry, Conquestor? Do we not possess the military might to obliterate both forces if necessary? Avault stiffened. Of course, Chancellor. But have you forgotten our latest intelligence from Lether? The third element in this foreign alliance intends to march through our kingdom. Perhaps even then we could crush all three forces, but at a dreadful cost. Furthermore, we do not know yet what agreements have been fashioned between the Lethary and these Malazans. We could well end up with the very war we did everything we could to avoid, resulting in the exposure of our deceptions with regard to our putative allies, the Safi and the Akrinai. Said deceptions making obvious the betrayals we intended, yet with us suddenly incapable of backing them with force. It is one thing to make promises only to abandon our allies in the field, if we cannot then occupy the lands of those allies once their armies have been annihilated, then the entire enterprise fails.
Let us assume for the moment, said Rava, that the Lethary threat no longer exists, and so the Great Balkando Alliance need never show its paper fangs. What we presently face at its worst is three disconnected armies marching every which way across our kingdom. One of those has now given us a bloody nose, but it is likely that the Cundrill will beat a hasty retreat now that they've satisfied their bloodlust. They will take their loot and flee into the wastelands. Naturally, that will be a fatal error. We need only move a few legions of your third regulars to occupy the border forts and trenchworks, so that whatever remnants of the Cundrill come crawling back will not present any sort of threat. He raised a finger. We must be sure to have our own commanders in charge, to profit from enslaving the Cundrill refugees.
Of course. To continue, then, we are left with the Parish and the Malazans, and both, by all counts, appear eminently civilized, of a sort to deplore the Cundrill excesses, and indeed they may end up feeling somewhat responsible. They may, in fact, offer reparations.
Avault had ceased pacing, and he now stood staring down at the Chancellor. What, then, of the ambush we were planning in the pass?
I would advise that it remain in place for the moment, Conquestor. At least until we are able to gauge the Mortal Sword's reaction when we deliver the news of the Cundrill and their unwarranted depredations.
I assume you will assure the Mortal Sword of our faith in her and her grey helms, said Avault, and that we recognize that the actions of barbarians, allies or not, cannot be predicted, and that we in no way hold the Parish responsible.
Rava was nodding. And so, having said just that, the fact that we are observed to array our escort in a defensive posture will simply indicate our cautious natures,
thus encouraging the Mortal Sword to make allowances in her desire to alleviate our newfound uncertainty.
Precisely. Well said, Conquestor.
Avault resumed pacing. So we drive the Cundrill into the wastelands and then enslave whoever makes it back. We ambush the Parish, resulting in a treasure trove of exquisite weaponry and armor, sufficient to outfit a new elite element.
Two units, Rava reminded him, your private guard and one for me as well.
As agreed, Chancellor. To resume, we are then facing one remaining army, the Malazans.
We must assume that word will reach them of the fate of their allies.
to which they will react, either with a perception of sudden vulnerability, in which case they will beat a retreat, or with anger, inciting aggression on their part.
Less than 10,000 of the fools, observed Rava. If we invite our allies among the Akrinai and Safi, we can divide the spoils.
I want those crossbows of theirs, Avalt said. I cannot tell you how frustrating it has been to fail again and again in stealing one thus far. With a legion or two armed with those weapons, I could overrun Safinand in a month.
All in due course, Rava said.
All of this assumes the Lethari do not get involved. The Chancellor sighed and then made a face.
My finest spies fall one after another in that court, and those few who have managed to escape are convinced that King Tehol is even worse than Tarkalf, a useless, bumbling idiot.
But you are not convinced, Chancellor?
Of course not. He paused and then said, most of the time. We may be dealing with a situation there uncannily identical to our own.
Avalt caught his breath, frozen in place once again.
Errant's nudge. Can it be, Rava?
I wish I knew. Tehol Bedigt's wife remains an unknown entity.
But surely not in a position to match Queen Abrasta.
Rava shrugged.
On the face of it, it seems unlikely. She possesses no private army, no elite units like Abrastal's Evertine Legion or anything comparable. If she has spies, and what queen doesn't, they seem to be engaged in intelligence gathering only, rather than active sabotage.
Yet, said Avalt, someone is clearly hunting down your spies.
Even there, I cannot be certain. Each has died in mysterious circumstances. Well, ones that I find mysterious. Tragic mishaps, each and every one. As if the errant himself was giving each one his personal attention.
Now that is an alarming thought, Chancellor.
Well, blessedly, not one has been exposed or captured. The accidents that have befallen them invariably resulted in sudden death.
Avalt frowned. The only situation I can imagine that fits the situation, Chancellor, is that our own networks have been so compromised by the Lethari that neither public exposure nor torture is deemed necessary. Such a notion chills me to the bone.
You assume the Lethari have managed that infiltration, said Rava. Is it not more likely that the compromise originates from within our own kingdom?
Surely not Tarkulf's spies.
No, we have them all in hand. No, my friend, is it truly inconceivable that the queen has her own agents ensconced in Tehol's palace?
Actively eliminating rivals, yes. That seems terrifyingly possible, conceded Avalt. Then what is she planning?
I wish I knew.
And Rava sat forward, fixing Avalt with a hard stare.
Assure me, Conquestor, that at no time will this situation force the queen into the fore. At no time, Avalt, will we give her reason to shove her useless husband aside and sound the call.
Avalt was suddenly trembling. The thought of the Evertine Legion stirred awake, actually on the march to clean up whatever mess the kingdom had been plunged into. No, that must not be.
Surely, he said, voice breaking. This present game is too small to concern Queen Abrastal.
Rava's face was grave. He lifted the parchment note and fluttered it like a tiny white flag.
An addendum informs me, Conquestor, that the king's 14th daughter and her handmaiden are no longer resident in the palace.
What? Where have they gone?
To that the Chancellor had no answer. And that silence filled Avalt with dread. The Balkando commanders took their time to emerge from their encampment and ascend with great ceremony to the rise where Tanakalian and the Mortal Sword stood. It was late afternoon. The Perish legions in full kit had formed up and were now marching to the floodplain 1,000 paces inland,
where the supply units had already begun staking out the tent rows and service blocks. The insects swarming over the brothers and sisters formed sunlit, glittering clouds that spun and whirled, even as orange-winged martins flickered through them. The river lizards that had been basking on the banks for most of the day had begun rising up on their stubby legs and slinking their way into the water, warily eyed by the herons and storks stalking the reedy shallows. Nights in this country, Tanakalian suspected, would not be pleasant. He could imagine all manner of horrid, poisonous creatures creeping, crawling, and flying in the sweltering, steamy darkness. The sooner they climbed into the mountain passes, the better he would feel. This notion of insanely inimical nature was new to him, and most unwelcome. His attention was drawn back to Chancellor Rava and Conquesta Avalt, as the unlikely pair, both riding chairs affixed to the saddled shoulders of four burly slaves slowly climbing the slope, rocked back and forth like kings on shaky thrones. Others flanked them with feather fans, keeping insects at bay. A train of a dozen more trailed the two men. This time, at least, there were no armored guards. Nothing so obvious, although Tanakalian suspected that more than a few of those supposed slaves were in fact bodyguards.
"Solemn greetings!" called the Chancellor, waving one limp hand.
He then snapped something to his porters, and they set down his chair. He stepped daintily onto the ground, adjusting his silken robes, and was joined moments later by Avalt. They strode up to the parish.
"A flawlessly executed landing. Congratulations, mortal sword. Your soldiers are indeed superbly trained."
"Kind words, Chancellor," Krukava rumbled in reply. "Strictly speaking, however, they are not my soldiers. They are my brothers and sisters. We are as much a priesthood as we are a military company."
"Of course," murmured Rava, "and this is certainly what makes you unique on this continent."
"Oh?"
Conquesta Avalt smiled and provided explanation.
"You arrive possessing a code of conduct unmatched by any native military force. We seek to learn much from you, matters of discipline and behavior that we can apply to our own people to the benefit of all."
"It distresses me," said Krughava, "that you hold your own soldiers in such low opinion, Conquestor."
Tanakalian squinted as if he'd caught a glare of sunlight from some distant weapon, and hoped that this seemingly unconscious expression hid his smile. When he looked back, he saw Avalt's own eyes widening within their cage of dyed scars, and then thinning.
"You misunderstand, mortal sword,"
Rava said.
"You have, perchance, already sensed something of the incessant intrigue compounding alliances and agreements of mutual protection between the border nations, mortal sword. Such things, while regrettable, are necessary. The Safi do not trust the Akrinai. The Akrinai do not trust the All, nor the Drasilhani. And the Balkando trust none of them. Foreign armies, we have all long since learned, cannot be held to the same high comportment as one holds one's own forces."
He spread his hands.
"Conquestor Avalt was simply expressing our unexpected pleasure in finding in you such unimpeachable honor."
"Ah," said Krughava, with all the percipient wit of a cliff goat. Avalt was struggling to master his anger, and Tanakalian knew that the mortal sword, for all her seemingly oblivious insensitivity, was well taking note of this interesting flaw in the commander overseeing Balkando Kingdom's combined military might. A commander with a temper and evidently poor discipline in mastering it, particularly in front of strangers and potential enemies, was one who would squander his soldiers to answer some insult, real or imagined. He was, therefore, both more dangerous and less threatening, the former for the risk of his doing the unexpected, the precipitous, and the latter for what would likely be a blunt, unsubtle execution, fueled by an overwhelming need for satisfaction. Tanakalian ran through these details in his mind, forcing himself to inwardly articulate the lessons that he knew Krughava had comprehended in an instant. Now that the destrient was gone, it fell to the shield anvil to seek a path as close as possible to the mortal sword, to find a way into her mind, to how she thought and those duties that drove her. During these moments of reflection, Chancellor Rava had been speaking.
"Unexpected tragedies, mortal sword, which have put us in a most awkward position. It is necessary, therefore, that we take measured pause here, whilst your formidable forces are poised outside the kingdom's boundaries."
Krughava had cocked her head.
"Since you have not yet described these tragedies, Chancellor, I can only observe that, from my experience, most tragedies are unexpected and invariably lead to awkwardness. Since it seems that the fact that we have not yet crossed into your kingdom is, for you, a salient point, am I to assume that your unexpected tragedies have in some way jeopardized our agreement?"
Now it was the Chancellor's turn to fail in disguising his irritation.
"You perish," he now said, tone brittle, "have acknowledged a binding alliance with the Kundril Burned Tears, who are guests of the kingdom at the moment, guests who have ceased to behave in a civilized fashion."
"Indeed. What leads you to this assessment, Chancellor?"
This assessment?
As Rava spluttered, speechless, Conquesta Avalt spoke sardonically.
"How might you assess the following, mortal sword? The Kundril have broken out of their settlement and are now raiding throughout the countryside, burning and looting farms, stealing herds, putting to the torch forts and hamlets, and indeed an entire town. But I am remiss in speaking only of material depredations. I forgot to mention scores of murdered soldiers and thousands of slaughtered civilians. I failed in citing the rapes and butchering of children."
"Enough!"
Krughava's bellow sent all the Balkando flinching back. The Chancellor was first to recover.
"Is this to be the manner of your vaunted honor, mortal sword?"
he demanded, red-faced, eyes bright.
"Can you not comprehend our newfound caution, nay, our distrust? Have we been led to expect such treachery?" "You go too far," said Krughava.
And Tanakalian saw the faint curl of a smile on her lips, a detail that took his breath away. It seemed to exert a similar effect upon the Balkando dignitaries, as Rava paled and Avalt settled a mailed hand on his sword.
"What?"
demanded Rava in a rasp.
"Does that mean?"
"You describe a local history of internecine treachery and incessant betrayal, sirs. So much so as to be part of your very natures. And then you express horror and outrage at the supposed betrayal of the Kundril. Your protestations are melodramatic, sirs, false in their extremity. I begin to see in you, Balkando, a serpent delighting in the cleverness of its own forked tongue."
She paused in the shocked silence and then added,
"When I invited you into the illusion of my ignorance, sirs, you slithered with eager glee. Who here among us, then, is the greater fool?"
Tanakalian gave credit to both men as he saw the rapid reassessment betrayed in their features. After a tense moment, Krughava continued in a quieter tone.
"Sirs, I have known War Leader Gaul of the Kundril Burned Tears for some time now. In the course of a long ocean voyage, no duplicities of character remain hidden. You assert the uniqueness of the Grey Helms, and in this you clearly reveal to me your lack of understanding with respect to the Kundril. The Burned Tears, sirs, are in fact a warrior cult, devoted to the very heart of their souls to a legendary war leader. This war leader, Coltane, was of such stature, such honor, that he earned worship not among his allies, but among his putative enemies, such as the Kundril Burned Tears."
She paused and then said,
"I am assured, therefore, that War Leader Gaul and his people were provoked. Possessed of admirable forbearance, as I know him to be, Gaul would have bowed as a sapling to the wind, until such time as the insults demanded answer. They have raided and conducted wholesale looting? From this detail, I conclude Balkando merchants and the king's agents sought to take advantage of the Khandril, imposing usurious increases in the price of essential supplies. Furthermore, you state that they broke out of their settlement. What manner of settlement requires a violent exit? The only one that comes to mind is one under siege. Accordingly, and in consideration of such provocation, I reaffirm the alliance between the Khandril Burned Tears and the Grey Helms. If enemies to us you choose to be, sirs, then we must consider that we are now at war. Attend to your brigade, Conquestor. It is tactically imperative that we obliterate your presence here prior to invading your kingdom. For all his doubt and suspicions, and indeed fears, Tanakalian was not averse to reveling in pride at this moment, seeing the effect of the mortal sword's words upon the Chancellor and the Conquestor, he felt savage pleasure. Play games with us, will you? The Khandril may sting, but the perish shall rend and tear. They would not call Krughava's bluff, for it was no bluff, and they both clearly knew it. Nor, Tanakalian knew, would they accede to a state of war, not here against the perish, and not, by extension, against the Burned Tears. The fools had miscalculated, badly miscalculated. And now would begin the desperate renewal of negotiations, and the footing that had heretofore been on a matching level, as courtesy demanded, was level no longer. After all, you may at this moment face two bridling, angry armies, my friends, and find yourselves shaking with terror. Wait until you meet the Bone Hunters. He watched as, following hasty reiterations of a desire to work things through peacefully, the Chancellor and the Conquestor retreated back down the slope, not even bothering with the ridiculous chairs. The slaves stumbled after them in a fan-waving mob. Beside him, Krughava sighed and then said, "It occurs to me, sir, that the Balkando expected the Khandril to prove little more than a minor irritant, confined to the region surrounding their settlement, easily contained, or indeed quickly driven over the border into the wastelands. That notion led inevitably to the conceit that we here could be isolated and dealt with at their leisure." "Then an ambush was intended all along? Or the threat thereof, to win further concessions?" "Well," said Tanakalian, "if the Khandril will neither remain close to their settlement nor retreat over the border, then it follows that but one course remains." She nodded. "As a barbed spear," she said, "Gaul will lead his people into the very heart of the kingdom." She rolled her shoulders in a rustle of chain and buckles. "Shield Anvil, inform the Legion commands that we are to march two bells before dawn." "Even if that means we are pursued by the Balkando escort?" She bared her teeth. "Have you gauged those troops, sir? They could be naked and not keep up with us. Their baggage train alone is thrice the size of their combatants in column. That," she pronounced, "is an army used to going nowhere." She set off, then, to beat down the two Balkando delegates, from flickering daggers to misshapen lumps of lead. Tanakalian, on the other hand, made his way to the perish camp. The insects were maddening, and from the rushes lining the river, birds screamed. The rain thrashed down, making the world grey and turning the stony track into a foaming stream. The tall black boles of the trees to either side loomed into view and then receded in rippling waves as Jan Tovis guided her horse down the now treacherous trail. Her waxed cloak was drawn tight about her, the hood pulled over her helm. 2 days and 3 nights of this, and she was chilled and soaked through. Ever since she had departed the city's road, 5 leagues from Dresh, cutting northward to where she had left her people, league after league of this forest had begun to weigh upon her. Her descent to the coast was also a journey into the past,
civilization fading into ghostly hopes in her wake. Patches of clear-cut meadow bordered by snarled bomas of cut branches, hacked brush and root stumps, the triple ruts of log tracks wending in and out, the rubbish of old camps and the ash heaps and trenches of charcoal makers, these marked the brutal imposition of Dresh's hunger and need. As with the islands of Cata Bight, desolation was the promise. As she had ridden through the old timber camps, she had seen the soil erosion, the deep rocky channels cutting through every clearing. And when in Dresh, resigning her commission, she had noted the nervousness among the garrison troops. Following a royal decree halting logging operations, there had been riots. Much of the city's wealth came from the forest, after all, and while the prohibition was a temporary one, during which the king's agents set about devising a new system, one centered on sustainability, the stink of panic clogged the city streets. Jan Tovis was not surprised that King Tehol had begun challenging the fundamental principles and practices of Lether, but she suspected that he would soon find himself a solitary, beleaguered voice of reason. Even common sense was an enemy to the harvesters of the future. The beast that was civilization ever faced forward, and in making its present world, it devoured the world to come. It was an appalling truth that one's own children could be so callously sacrificed to immediate comforts, yet this was so, and it had always been so. Dreamers were among the first to turn their backs on historical truths. King Tehol would be swept aside, drowned in the inexorable tide of unmitigated growth. No one, after all, can stand between the glutton and the feast. She wished him well, even as she knew he would fail. In the midst of pelting rain, she had left the camps behind, taking one of the old wood bison migration routes through virgin forest. The mud of the ancient track swarmed with leeches, and she was forced to dismount every bell or so to tug the mottled black and brown creatures from her horse's legs, until the path led down onto a sinkhole basin that proved to be a salt trap. The plague of leeches ended abruptly and, as she continued downslope, did not return. Signs of the old dwellers began to appear. Perhaps they were shake remnants. Perhaps they belonged to a people now forgotten. She saw the slumping humps of round huts covered in wax-leaved vines. She saw on the massive trunks of the most ancient trees crumbled visages carved by hands long since rotted to nothing. The wooden faces were smeared in black slime, moss and lumps of sickly fungi. She halted her mount beside one such creation and stared at it through the rain for a long time. She could think of no finer symbol of impermanence. The blunted expression, its pits of sorrow that passed for eyes, these things haunted her long after she had left the ruined settlement. The track eventually merged with a shake road that had once joined two coastal villages, and this was the path she now took. The rain had become a deluge, and its hissing rose to a roar on her hood, a curtain of water sheeting down in front of her eyes. Her horse halted suddenly, and she lifted her head to see a lone rider blocking her path. He seemed a figure sculpted in flowing water. "Listen to me," she said, loud, unexpectedly harsh. "Do you truly imagine that you can follow us, brother?" Yedan Derig made no reply, his typical statement of obstinacy. She wanted to curse him, but knew that even that would be useless. "You killed the witches and warlocks. Pulley and Squish are not enough. Do you understand what you have forced upon me, Yedan?" He straightened in his saddle at that. Even in the gloom, she saw his jaws bunching as he chewed for a time on his reply before saying, "You cannot, you must not, make the journey, sister, upon the mortal path. Because it is the only one you can follow, banished as you are." But he shook his head. "The road you seek is but a promise, never attempted. A promise, Jan Tovis. Will you risk the lives of our people upon such a thing?"
"You have left me no choice."
"Take the mortal path as you said you would, eastward to Blue Rose and thence across the sea." She wanted to scream at him. Instead, she bared her teeth.
"You damned fool, Yedan. Have you seen the camp of my people? the population of the whole island, old prisoners and their families, merchants and hawkers, cutthroats and pirates, everyone joined us. Not even including the Sheikh. There are close to 10,000 Lethary refugees in my camp. What am I to do with them all? How do I feed them?
They are not your responsibility, Twilight. Disperse them. The islands are very nearly underwater now. This crisis belongs to King Tehol, to Lether.
You forget, she snapped. Second Maiden proclaimed its independence and made me queen. The moment we arrived on the mainland, we became invaders.
He cocked his head. It is said the king is a compassionate man.
He may well be, but how will everyone else think? All those people whose lands we must cross. When we beg for food and shelter, when our hunger grasps tight our souls so that begging becomes demands. The Northern Territories have not yet recovered from the Edur War. Fields lie fallow. The places where sorcery was unleashed now seethe with nightmare creatures and poisonous plants. I will not descend upon King Tehol's most fragile subjects with 15,000 desperate trespassers.
Take me back then, Yedan said. Your need for me.
I cannot. You are a witch slayer. You would be torn to pieces.
Then find a worthy mate, a king.
Yedan Derek, move aside. I will speak with you no longer.
He collected his reins and made way for her to pass.
The mortal path, sister. Please.
Coming alongside, she raised a gloved hand as if to strike him, then lowered it and kicked her horse forward. Feeling his gaze upon her back was not enough to twist her round in her saddle. The weight of his disapproval settled on her shoulders, and with a faint shock she discovered that it was not entirely unfamiliar. Perhaps, as a child, well, some traits refused to go away no matter the span of years. The notion made her even more miserable. A short time later she caught the rank smell of cook fires dying in the rain.
My people, my realm, I am home.
Pithy and Brevity sat on a rolled-up, half-buried log at what used to be the high water mark, their bare feet in the lukewarm water of the sea's edge. The story went that this precious, magical mix of fresh rain and salty surf was a cure for all manner of foot ailments, including bad choices that sent one walking in entirely the wrong direction. Of course, life being what it is, you can't cure what you ain't done yet, though it never hurts to try.
Besides, said Brevity, her short dark hair flattened onto her round cheeks, if we didn't swing the vote, you and me, why, we'd be swimming to the nearest tavern right about now. Praying that there's still some beer on tap, Pithy added. It was the ice melt, dearie, that done in the island. And sure, maybe it would have subsided some, maybe even enough, but who wanted to hold their breaths waiting for that?
She pulled a sodden rust-leaf stick from some fold in her cloak and jammed it in the corner of her mouth.
Anyway, we got us a queen now, and a government.
A divided government, Brevity. Sheikh on one side, Forters on the other, and the queen hog-tied and stretched in between. I can hear her creaking day and night. What we're looking at here is an impasse, and it won't hold that way for much longer.
Well, with only two witches left, it's not like the Sheikh can do nothing but wave a bony fist our way.
Pithy kicked her feet, making desultory splashes quickly beaten down by the rain.
We need to make our move soon. We need to swing the queen over to our side. You and me, Brev, we should be leading the contingent to King Tehol with a tidy resettlement scheme that includes at least three chests heaped with coins.
One for you, one for me, and one for Twilight's treasury.
Precisely.
Think she'll go for it?
Why not? We can't stay here on this rotten coast much longer, can we?
Good point. She saved us from drowning on the island, didn't she? No point in then having us drown here in the errant's endless piss. Fence toes, what a miserable place this is.
You know, said Pithy after a time, you and me, we could just abandon them all. Make our way to Letharus. How long do you think it'd take us to get re-established?
Brevity shook her head.
We'd get recognized, dearie. Worse, our scheme ain't going to work a second time. People will see the signs and know it for what it is.
Ah, every 5 years, by my count, you can find another crop of fools with too much money. Happy to hand it over.
Maybe, but it's not the marks I was thinking about. It's the authorities. I ain't in no mood to get arrested all over again. Twice offending means the drownings for sure.
Pithy shivered. Got a point there.
All right, then we go the honest politician route. We climb the ladder of secular power. We soak and scam legitimately.
Brevity sucked on the stick and then nodded.
We can do that. Popularity contest. We divide up our rivals in the putative assembly. You bed one half, I bed the other. We set ourselves up as bitter rivals and make up two camps. Get voted as the Assembly's official representatives to the court of the Queen. And then we become the choke point. Information and wealth, up and down, down and up. Neither side knowing anything but what we decide to tell them.
Precisely. No real difference from being the lying, cheating brokers we once were.
Right. Only even more crooked.
But with a smile.
With a smile. Always, dearie.
Jan Tovis rode down into the camp. The place stank. Figures stumbled in the mud and rain. The entire shallow bay offshore was brown with churned-up runoff. They were short of food. All the boats anchored in the bay sat low, wallowing in the rolling waves. The mortal path. Twilight shook her head. Unmindful of the countless eyes finding her as she rode into the makeshift town, she continued on until she reached the witch's tent. Dismounting, she stepped over the drainage trench and ducked inside.
"We's in trouble," croaked Squish from the far end. "People getting sick now. We's running out of herbs and was not."
She fixed baleful eyes on Twilight. At her side, Pulley smacked her gums for a moment and then asked,
"What you going to do, Queenie, before everyone dies?"
She did not hesitate.
"We must journey, but not on the mortal path."
Could two ancient women be shocked? Seemed they could.
"By my royal blood," Twilight said, "I will open the road to Galan."
She stared down at the witches, their gaping mouths, their wide eyes.
"To the dark shore. I am taking us home."
He wished he could remember his own name. He wished for some kind of understanding. How could such a disparate collection of people find themselves stumbling across this ravaged landscape? Had the world ended? Were they the last ones left? But no, not quite. Not quite accurate. While none of his companions, bickering and cursing, showed any inclination to glance back on their own trail, he found his attention drawn again and again to that hazy horizon whence they had come. Someone was there. Someone was after them. If he could find out all the important things, he might have less reason to fear. He might even discover that he knew who hunted them. He might find a moment of peace. Instead, the others looked ahead, as if they had no choice, no will to do otherwise. The edifice they had set out towards, what seemed weeks ago, was finally drawing near. Its immensity had mocked their sense of distance and perspective, but even that was not enough to account for the length of their trek. He had begun to suspect that his sense of time was awry, that the others measured the journey in a way fundamentally different from him. For was he not a ghost? He could only slip into and through them like a shadow. He felt nothing of the weight of each step they took. Even their suffering eluded him. And yet, by all manner of reason, should he not be the one to have found time compacted, condensed to a thing of ephemeral ease? Why then the torture in his soul, the exhaustion? This fevered sense of crawling along every increment inside each of these bodies, one after another, round and round and round. When he first awoke among them, he had felt himself blessed. Now he felt trapped. The edifice reared into the scoured blue sky, grey and black, carved scales possibly rent by fractures and mottled with rusty stains. It was a tower of immense alien artistry. At first, it had seemed little more than wreckage,
a looming, rotted fang rendered almost shapeless by centuries of abandonment. But the closing of distance had, perversely, altered that perception. Even so, on the flat land spreading out from its base, there was no sign of settlement, no ancient blunted furrows betraying once planted fields, no tracks, no roads. They could discern the nature of the monument now. Perhaps 1,000 reaches tall, it stood alone, empty-eyed, a dragon of stone balanced on its hind limbs and curling tail. One of its forelimbs reached down to sink talons into the ground. The other was drawn up and angled slightly outward, as if poised to swipe some enemy from its path. Even its hind limbs were asymmetrically positioned, tensed, coiled. No real dragon could match its size, and yet as they edged closer, mute now, diminished, they could see the astonishing detail of the creation, the iridescence of the whorls in each scale, lightly coated in dust, the folded back skin encircling the talons, talons which were at least half again as tall as a man, their polished, laminated surfaces scarred and chipped. They could see creases in the hide that they had first taken to be fractures, the weight of muscles hanging slack, the seams and blood vessels in the folded, arching wings. A grainy haze obscured the edifice above its chest height, as if it was enwreathed in a ring of suspended dust.
No, whispered Taxilian, not suspended. That ring is moving, round and round it swirls. Do you see?
Sorcery, said Breath, her tone oddly flat.
As might a million moons orbit a dead sun, Rortos observed. Countless lifeless worlds, each one no bigger than a grain of sand. You say magic holds it in place, Breath? Are you certain?
What else? She snapped, dismissive. All we ever get from you, theories about this and that, as if explanations meant anything. What difference does knowing make, you fat oaf?
It eases the fire in my soul, witch, Rortos replied.
The fire is the reason for living.
Until it burns you up.
Oh, stop it, you two, moaned Asana.
Breath wheeled on her.
I'm going to drown you, she pronounced. I don't even need water to do it. I'll use sand. I'll hold you under and feel your every struggle, your every twitch.
It's not just a statue, said Taxilian.
Someone carved down a mountain, said Nappet. Means nothing. It's just stupid, useless. We've walked for days and days for this, stupid. I'm of a mind to kick you bloody, Taxilian, for wasting my time.
Wasting your time? Why, Nappet, what else were you planning to do?
We need water. Now we're going to die out here, just so you could look at this piece of stone.
Nappet lifted a battered fist.
If I kill you, we can drink your blood. That'll hold us for a time.
It will kill you in turn, Rortos said. You will die in great pain.
What do you know about it? We'll cook you down and drink all that melted fat.
It's not just a statue, Taxilian repeated. Last, who was not much for talking, surprised everyone when he said,
He's right. It was alive once, this dragon.
Sheb snorted.
Errant save us, you're an idiot, Last. This thing was never anything but a mountain.
It was no mountain, Last insisted, brow darkening. There are no mountains here, and there never were. Anybody can see that. No, it was alive.
He's right, I think, said Taxilian. Only maybe not in the way you think, Sheb. This was built, and then it was lived in.
He spread his hands.
It is a city, and we're going to find a way inside.
The ghost, who had been hovering, swept this way and that, impatient and fearful, anxious and excited, now wanted to cry out with joy, and would have, had he a voice.
A city?
Sheb stared at Taxilian for a long moment and then spat.
But abandoned now, right? Dead, right?
I would say so,
Taxilian replied. Long dead.
So, and Sheb licked his lips, there might be loot, forgotten treasure. After all, who else has ever come out here? The wastelands promise nothing but death. Everyone knows that. We're probably the first people to have ever seen this.
Barring its inhabitants, murmured Rortos. Taxilian, can you see a way inside?
No, not yet. But come, we'll find one, I'm certain of it. Breath stepped in front of the others as if to block their way.
This place is cursed. Can't you feel that? It doesn't belong to people. People like you and me. We don't belong here. Listen to me. If we go inside, we'll never leave.
Asana whimpered, shrinking back.
I don't like it either. We should just go, like she says.
We can't, barked Sheb. We need water. How do you think a city this size can survive here? It's sitting on a source of water.
Which probably dried up, and that's why they left.
Dried up maybe for 10,000 thirsty souls, not seven. And who knows how long ago? No, you don't understand. If we don't find water in there, we're all going to die.
The ghost was oddly baffled by all this. They had found a spring only two evenings back. They all carried water skins that still sloshed, although, come to think of it, he could not recall where they had found them. Did his companions always have those skins? And what about the broad hats they wore, shielding them from the bright, hard sunlight? The walking sticks, Taxilian's rope-handled scribe box, Rortus's map case that folded out into a desktop, Breath's cloak of sewn pockets, each pocket carrying a tile, Nappet and his knotted skullbreaker tucked into his belt, Sheb's brace of daggers, Asana's spindle and the bag of raw wool from which she spun out her lacy webs, Last's iron pot and fire kit, his hand sickle and collection of cooking knives. Where, the ghost wondered, in faint horror, had all these things come from?
No food, no water, Nappet was saying. Sheb's right. But most importantly, if we find a door, we can defend it.
The words hung in the silence that followed, momentarily suspended and then slowly rising like grit. The ghost could see them, the way they lost shape, but not meaning, definition, but not dread import. Yes, Nappet had spoken aloud the secret knowledge, the words that terror had carved bloody on their souls. Someone was hunting them. Asana began weeping, softly, sodden hitches catching in her throat. Sheb's hands closed into fists as he stared at her. But Nappet had turned to face Last, and was eyeing the huge man speculatively.
I know, he said. You're a thick-skulled farmer, Last. But you look strong. Can you handle a sword? If we need someone to hold the portal, can you do that?
The man frowned and then nodded.
Maybe I ain't never used a sword, but nobody will get past. I swear it. Nobody gets past me.
And Nappet was holding a sheathed sword, which he now offered to Last. The ghost recoiled upon seeing that weapon. He knew it, yet knew it not. A strange, frightening weapon. He watched as Last drew the sword from its sheath. Single-edged, dark, mottled iron, its tip weighted and slightly flaring. The deep ferrule running the length of the blade was a black, nightmarish streak, like an etching of the abyss itself. It stank of death, the whole weapon, this terrible instrument of destruction. Last hefted the sword in his hand.
I would rather a spear, he said.
We don't like spears, Nappet hissed, do we?
No,
the others chorused. Last's frown deepened.
No, me neither. I don't know why I wanted one. An imp's whisper in my head, I guess.
And he made a warding gesture. Sheb spat to seal the fend.
We don't like spears, Rortos whispered. They're dangerous.
The ghost agreed, fleshless and yet chilled, shivering. There had been a spear in his past, yes, perhaps? A dreadful thing lunging at his face, his chest, slicing the muscles of his arms, reverberations shivering up through his bones, rocking him back one step, then another.
Gods, he did not like spears. Come on, Taxilian said. It is time to find the way in. There was a way in. The ghost knew that. There was always a way in. The challenge was in finding it, in seeing it and knowing it for what it was. The important doors stayed hidden, disguised, shaped in ways to deceive. The important doors opened from one side only, and once you were through, they closed in a gust of cold air against the back of the neck, and could never be opened again. Such was the door he sought, the ghost realized. Did it wait in this dead city? He would have to find it soon, before the hunter found him, found them all.
Spear wielder, slayer, the one who does not retreat, who mocks in silence, who would not flinch. No, he's not done with me, with us, with me, with us. We need to find the door, a way in.
They reached the dragon's stone forelimb with its claws that stood arrayed like massive tapering pillars of marble, tips sunk deep into the hard earth. Everywhere surrounding the foundations, the ground was fissured, fraught with cracks that tracked outward. Rotos grunted as he crouched down to peer into one such rent.
Deep, he muttered. The city is settling, suggesting that it has indeed sucked out the water beneath it.
Taxilian was scanning the massive tower that comprised the limb in front of them, tilting his head back and back. After a moment, he staggered, cursing.
Too much, he gasped. This one leg could encompass a half dozen early spires. If it is indeed hollow, it could hold 1,000 inhabitants all by itself.
And yet, Rotos said, coming up alongside him, look at the artistry, the genius of the sculptors. Have you ever seen such skill on such a scale, Taxilian?
No, it surpasses. It surpasses. Sheb stepped in between two of the talons, slipped into shadows and out of sight. There were no obvious entranceways, no formal portals or ramps, no gates, no windows or apertures higher up.
It seems entirely self-contained, said Taxilian. Did you notice no evidence of outlying farms or pasture land?
None that survived the interval of abandonment, Rotos replied. For all we know, after all, this could be 100,000 years old.
That would surprise me. Yes, the surface is eroded, worn down. But if it was as old as you suggest, why, it would be little more than a shapeless lump, a giant termite tower.
Are you certain of that?
No, Taxilian admitted. But I recall once, in a scriptorium in Erlitan, seeing a map dating from the First Empire. It showed a line of rugged hills inland of the city. They ran like a spine parallel to the coast. Elevations had been noted here and there. Well, those hills are still there, but not as bold or as high as what was noted on the map.
And how old was the map?
Rotos asked. Taxilian shrugged.
20,000? 50? 5? Scholars make a career of not agreeing on anything.
Was the map on hide? Surely no hide could last so long, not even 5,000 years.
Hide, yes, but treated in some arcane way. In any case, it had been found in a wax-sealed container. Seven Cities is mostly desert. Without moisture, nothing decays. It just shrinks, dries up.
He gestured with one hand at the stone facade before them.
Anyway, this should be much more weathered if it was so old as to outlast signs of farming.
Rotos nodded, convinced by Taxilian's reasoning.
Haunted, said Breath. You're going to get us all killed, Taxilian. So I now curse your name, your soul. I will make you pay for killing me.
He glanced at her, said nothing. Rotos spoke.
See that hind foot, Taxilian? It is the only one on a pedestal.
The two men headed off in that direction. Breath walked up to Asana.
Spin that cocoon, woman. Make yourself somewhere you can hide inside, until you're nothing but a rotted husk.
Don't think you can crawl back out. Don't think you can show us all your bright painted wings. Your hopes, Asana, your dreams and secrets, all hollow.
She held up a thin, spidery hand.
I can crush it all so easily.
Last stepped up to her, then pushed her back so that she stumbled.
I grow tired of listening to you, he said. Leave her alone.
Breath cackled and danced away.
Thank you, said Asana. She is so hurtful.
At last faced her and said,
This is not a place for fears, Asana. Conquer yours, and do it soon.
Nearby, Nappet snickered.
Dumb farmers may be not so dumb after all. Doesn't make him any less ugly, though, does it?
He laughed. As Rortos and Taxilian drew closer to the hind limb, they could see that the pedestal was rectangular, like the foundation of a temple. The vertical wall facing them, as tall as they were, bore the faint remnants of a frieze, framed in an elaborate border, all too eroded to interpret, but no sign of an entranceway.
We are confounded again, Rortos said.
I do not think so, Taxilian replied. You look wrongly, friend. You search out what rises in front of you. You scan right and left. You crane your sight upward. Yes, the city encourages such deception. The dragon invites it, perched as it is, and yet...
He pointed. Rortos followed the line of that lone finger and grunted in surprise. At the base of the pedestal, wind-blown sands formed a hollow.
The way in is downward.
Sheb joined them.
We need to dig.
I think so, agreed Taxilian. Call the others, Sheb.
I don't take orders from you. Errant piss on you highborn bastards.
I'm not highborn, said Taxilian.
Sheb sneered.
You make like you are, which is just as bad. Get back down where you belong, Taxilian, and if you can't manage on your own, then I'll help, and that's a promise.
I just have some learning, Sheb. Why does that threaten you so?
Sheb rested a hand on one of his daggers.
I don't like pretenders, and that's what you are. You think big words make you smarter, better. You like the way Rortos here respects you. You think he sees you as an equal. But you're wrong in that. You ain't his equal. He's just humouring you, Taxilian. You're a clever pet.
This is how Lethary think, said Rortos, sighing. It's what keeps everyone in their place, upward, downward, even as people claim they despise the system, they end up doing all they can to keep it in place.
Taxilian sighed in turn.
I do understand that, Rortos. Stability helps remind you of where you stand. Affirms you've got a legitimate place in society, for good or ill.
Listen to you two shit-eaters!
By this time the others had arrived. Taxilian pointed at the depression.
We think we've found a way in, but we'll have to dig.
Last approached with a shovel in his hands.
I'll start.
The ghost hovered, watching. Off to the west, the sun was settling into horizon's lurid vein. When Last needed a rest, Taxilian took his place. Then Nappet, followed by Sheb. Rortos tried then, but by this point the pit was deep, and he had difficulty making his way down, and an even harder time flinging the sand high enough to keep it from sifting back. His stint did not last long before, with a snarl, Sheb told him to get out and leave the task to the lowborns who knew this business. Last and Taxilian struggled to lift Rortos out of the pit. In the dusty gloom below, the excavation had revealed one edge of stone facing, the huge block set without mortar. The argument from earlier disturbed the ghost, although he was not sure why it was so. He was past such silly things, after all. The games of station, so bitter, so self-destructive, it all seemed such a waste of time and energy, the curse of people who could look outward but never inward. Was that a measure of intelligence? Were such hapless victims simply dim-witted, incapable of introspection and honest self-judgment? Or was it a quality of low intelligence that its possessor instinctively fled the potentially deadly turmoil of knowing too many truths about oneself? Yes, it was this notion of self-delusion that left him feeling strangely anxious, exposed and vulnerable. He could see its worth, after all. When the self was a monster, who wouldn't hide from such a thing? Who wouldn't run when it loomed close, close enough to smell, to taste? Yes, even the lowest beast knew the value of not knowing itself too well.
"I've reached the floor,"
announced Cheb, straightening. When the others crowded to the uncertain edge, he snarled,
"Keep your distance, fools! You want to bury me?"
"Tempting," said Nappet. "But then we'd have to dig out your miserable corpse."
The shovel scraped on flagstones. After a time, Cheb said,
"Got the top of the doorway here in front of me. It's low, but wide. There's a ramp, no steps."
"Yes," thought the ghost. "That is as it should be."
Cheb wasn't interested in handing off the task, now that he could see the way in. He dug swiftly, grunting with every upward heave of heavy, damp sand.
"I can smell the water," he gasped. "Could be the tunnels flooded, but at least we won't die of thirst, will we?"
"I'm not going down there," said Breath. "If there's water in the tunnel, I'm not. You'll all drown."
The ramp angled downward for another 6 or 7 paces, enough to leave Cheb exhausted. Nappet took over, and a short time later, with dusk gathering at their backs, a thrust of the shovel plunged into empty space. They were through. The tunnel beyond was damp, the air sweet with rotting mould and sour with something fouler. The water pooled on the floor was less than a finger's width deep, slippery underfoot. The darkness was absolute. Everyone lit lanterns. Watching this, the ghost found himself frightened yet again. As with all the other accoutrements, as with the sudden appearance of the shovel, he was missing essential details. They could not simply veer into existence as needed, after all. Reality didn't work that way. No, it must be that he was blind to things, a vision cursed to be selective, yielding only that which was needed, that which was relevant to the moment. For all he knew, he suddenly realized there might be a train of wagons accompanying this group. There might be servants, bodyguards, an army. The real world, he comprehended with a shock, was not what he saw, not what he interacted with instant by instant. The real world was unknowable. He thought he might howl. He thought he might give voice to his horror, his abject revelation. For if indeed the world was unknowable, then so too were the forces acting upon him. And how could one guard against that? Frozen, unable to move, until the group descended into the tunnel, and then yet another discovery assailed him, as chains dragged him down into the pit, pulling him, shrieking now, into the passageway. He was not free. He was bound to the lives of these strange people, not one of whom knew he even existed. He was their slave, yet rendered so useless that he had no voice, no body, no identity beyond this fragile mockery of self. And how long could such an entity survive when it was invisible to everyone else, when even the stone walls and pools of slimy water did not acknowledge his arrival? Was this, then, the torment of all ghosts? The possibility was so terrible, so awful, that he recoiled. How could mortal souls deserve such eternal penitence? What vast crime did the mere act of living commit? Or had he been personally consigned to this fate by some god or goddess cruel in judgment, devoid of all mercy? At that thought, even as he flailed about in the wake of his masters, he felt a sudden rage, a blast of indignation.
"What god or goddess dares to presume the right to judge me? That is arrogance too vast to have been earned. Whoever you are, I will find you. I swear it. I will find you and I will cut you down, humble you, down to your knees. How dare you? How dare you judge anyone when you ever hide your face? When you strip away all possible truth of your existence, your willful presence? Hiding from me, whoever, whatever you are, is a childish game,
an unworthy game. Face your child. Face all your children. Show me the veracity of your right to cast judgment upon me. Do this, and I will accept you. Remain hidden, even as you consign my soul to suffering, and I will hunt you down. I will hunt you down.
The ramp climbed until it reached a broad, low-ceilinged chamber, crowded with reptilian corpses, rotting, reeking, in pools of thick ichor and rank blood. 20, perhaps more. Kachain Chemal, the makers of this city, each one throat cut, executed like goats on an altar. Beyond them, a spiraling ramp climbed steeply upward. No one said a thing as they picked careful, independent paths through the slaughter. Taxilian in the lead, they began the ascent. The ghost watched as breath paused to bend down and run a finger through decaying blood. She slipped that finger into her mouth and smiled.